somehow I'll return again to you. The secret of your beauty and the mystery of your soul, I've been searching for in everyone I meet. And the times I've been mistaken, it's impossible to say. And the grass is growing underneath our feet.
this edition of Blind Vine for September 20th, 2007. I'm your host, Chris Gray, broadcasting from the James Flood Building in beautiful downtown San Francisco. We're at the corner of Market and Powell, the busiest intersection on the west coast of the United States. And today I'm not sure if it's busier with cars or pedestrians. I never ran across so many crowds of people in my life getting down here to my office and the studio for broadcasting of this show. I'm your host, Chris Gray. We have an exciting program for you today. I'll be back to tell you more about it in just one moment. Well, as I told you last week and mentioned in some notices about Blind Vine, Marvelyn and I were in Europe for some time during the month of August, part of August and part of September, and we do plan to create a show for you about that and have a program, something like, oh, let's go Europe, or I don't know what we're going to call it exactly, but should be a great opportunity to talk about how people live in Europe, a lot about how they eat in Europe. My gosh, we did a lot of eating. But we'll talk about train travel, we'll talk about communications, we'll talk about as many things as we can that relate to our work in the American Council of the Blind, and give you a sense of at least three or four countries: Austria, Switzerland, France, and a little bit about Germany as well. We spend a lot of time traveling by train. We can talk about that. And just had a lot of very fun and interesting experiences. We'll also spend some time chatting about the quadrennial meetings of the World Blind Union. Well, once again, to recap the last couple of weeks, we've had some great successes for ACB. For those of you who may not have heard last week, we are working diligently with our attorneys to prepare language to announce that all blind and visually impaired people who are Social Security recipients are a part of a class now, a class action suit, and ACB is bound and determined that Social Security will comply with the law and that they will provide letters and other important information to recipients or applicants in a form that those people can read. This has only been the law, folks, since 1979. And here, Social Security is, after all these years, not raising a finger to comply with what they know they should be doing. Several of us have been involved in this litigation, and we've had a lot of great help as well from the Disability Rights and Educational Defense Fund. We've had other assistance from an Oregon Law Center and have done very well so far. And, of course, the law firm which is doing a lot of the pro bono work, major law firm in the United States, Heller Ehrman. So all that is very good news. As I observed last week, the Treasury has let the two dates go by they could appeal, so we're now trying to negotiate with them. Many of you will have received a questionnaire from a contractor to the Department of the Treasury, and this questionnaire is quite lengthy, but I sincerely hope that you will fill it out, and you'll fill all of it out, because it's the part near the end that is the most relevant to the Treasury litigation. So it gives them information about what we feel would be an appropriate kind of amelioration to our lack of accessible currency, and is very important for us to get back to the subcontractor so that they can provide Treasury information about what the blind community as a whole really wants. This isn't necessarily just ACB or any one organization. It's what the blind community as a whole wants to make their currency accessible. Those are the main news items I want to focus on today. A lot of other stuff going on. There's a conference being planned for the Western region of the United States to help train new leadership for ACB. There are stirrings of other potential leadership seminars around the country. We're gearing up for a board meeting before our in-person board meeting to talk about a few matters that can't wait. So the date has probably been selected for that. I believe it's October the 1st. And then just the general hustle and bustle of organizational business going on that we have to do in the American Council of the Blind. Well, this week, as my main feature, I promised to run Lecture 2 from the teaching company about the Olympics. It's a free lecture, and you could get it online if you were to go to www.teachingcompany.com. And because of the teaching company's largesse, of course, it's a bit of self-promotion and a bit of advertising, but, you know, so what? It's also fascinating material to listen to. I, from time to time, take teaching company classes, which is how I came to find out about this. The ones I've taken, I've enjoyed very much. We had, around Memorial Day, a 30-minute lecture about D-Day. In early August, I played lecture one of a two-part series about the Olympics, and now we'll go to lecture number two. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope we have some time at the very end for your phone calls. Should you care to note it down, don't call me during the lecture, but just so you'll know, the phone number is 888-881-1998 for those calling from the U.S., or 415-217-6667 for those calling outside the U.S. Now we go to Lecture 2 from the teaching company about the Olympic Games.
In honor of the Olympics, the teaching company is proud to present a pair of free commissioned lectures, Ancient Origins of the Olympic Games. The lecturer is Professor Jeremy McInerney, Davidson Kennedy Associate Professor in the Department of Classical Studies and Chair of the Graduate Group in Ancient History at the University of Pennsylvania. He received his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. One of our most popular instructors, Professor McInerney, teaches three of the great courses, Ancient Greek Civilization, The Age of Pericles, and Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic Age. Feel free to send the link to this lecture to any family or friends who also might enjoy it. It is free for them as well.
Hello and welcome back to the second of our little mini-series of lectures on the Olympics. In the first lecture, I spent a good deal of time talking about the Homeric background to the Olympic Games because I wanted to make the point that the Homeric heroes are really the model for the Olympic hero, and that the Olympics give the Greeks of the 8th and the 7th century and then later into the classical period the opportunity to behave in the way that they associate with their models, the heroes in the Homeric poems. And we talked a little bit about the specific events, such as the sprinting and the boxing, the long-distance events, and the pentathlon. And then I spent a little time talking about the equestrian events, showing just what chaos and mayhem there must have been going on in the hippodrome as these chariots and horses were racing around. Now, the Olympics, as I pointed out, most people believe begin in 776 BC, and they continued with very few interruptions until 394 AD. That's a period of just under 1,200 years, we're just celebrating, we've only just celebrated the 100 years of the Olympics of the modern era, so we've got a long way to go, well over a millennium, before we catch up to the ancients in terms of the longevity of the ancient institution. But as you would expect, in antiquity, just as in the modern Olympics, some events dropped out and some events were added. One such change involved an arduous race that lasted well into the classical age, but then seems to have been dropped before the Roman period. This was an 800-meter race that was carried out in armor. It was called the Hoplitodromos, which means the race of the hoplites, or the race of the heavily armed infantrymen. And in this race, and we have depictions of this on vases, so we know what it looked like, athletes wore the bronze helmets that warriors wore in battle. They wore the bronze greaves on their lower legs, as if they were protecting their legs for battle. And they carried the heavy wooden and bronze shield of a hoplite warrior. It was apparently an incredibly popular event among the spectators, but it must have been one of the most punishing events on the program, and I think that the athletes were quite happy when they saw it dropped. You'll notice that there was no marathon race in the ancient Olympics. We've talked about what the schedule of events was, and I didn't mention the marathon. The race does have a classical association. That's to say, the modern marathon has a classical association because it takes its name from the place outside of Athens where in 490 BC the Athenians drove the Persian invaders back into the sea. However, there was no sporting event associated with this in antiquity. What happened was that on the eve of the Battle of Marathon, a long-distance runner named Pheidippides ran nearly 150 miles in 2 days from Athens to Sparta to bring an Athenian request for help against the Persians. The Spartans didn't make it in time, but the Athenians prevailed nonetheless, and they defeated the Persians, driving them back into the sea at Marathon. So we use the term marathon to describe a race, but the actual episode in antiquity was much longer than 26 miles, and it wasn't even a race at all. Now, there was another story told in antiquity, but it's a much later story, and that is that Pheidippides had run from Marathon to Athens to bring the news of the victory at Marathon. According to this story, he arrived in Athens, delivered the good news, "We are victorious," and promptly dropped dead. It's a terrific story, but it is not in any way, shape, or form authentic. The distance of the modern marathon, 26 miles, only very loosely approximates the distance from the town of Marathon to Athens. In actuality, it's based on the distance from Windsor Castle to the White City Stadium in London when the marathon was run at the London Olympics in 1908. So there you have a perfect blending of the ancient and the modern, but with very little connection to the ancient Olympics. That's only one of the many ways in which the modern and the ancient games differ. There were no swimming events at the ancient Olympics, no water sports such as rowing or kayaking, no winter sports such as skiing or bobsledding. A more significant difference, and I don't mean to be facetious by listing these differences because they actually do tell us something about the spirit of the ancient games, but a more important difference is that there were no team sports, whether it be volleyball, soccer, or field hockey. The ancient Olympics were very much a matter of individual athletes exerting themselves against other individuals. Furthermore, and again this is, I think, significant, no women participated as competitors at the ancient Olympic Games. In fact, only young unmarried girls were even allowed in as spectators. Married women were barred on pain of death from watching these naked men in their athletic competitions. We hear of a woman named Kallipatera who trained her son after her husband died and who then accompanied him to the Olympics dressed as a man. But when her son was victorious, in her exuberance, she jumped over the barrier, snagging her clothes, and it was revealed when they fell off that she was, in fact, a woman. She faced death, but she was pardoned by the judges because, aside from her son, her father, her three brothers, and her nephew were all Olympic victors. A story that tells us not only that it was exceptional for women to be at the Olympics, but that Olympic victors ran in families. And this is not the only instance where we know of multi-generations. In fact, it was not uncommon for three generations of the same family to compete victoriously at the Olympics. Unmarried girls could compete in a running race that was held at a separate event. And this was part of the festival in honour of Hera, the Queen of Heaven. But this was kept quite separate from the main Olympic competition, which, of course, was a festival in honour of Zeus. We have a description of these female competitors wearing short Amazonian-style chitons or tunics, draped over their shoulder to leave one breast exposed. And even if the description sounds a little odd, we have a bronze statuette from 6th century Sparta that shows a running girl wearing exactly such an outfit. And she's seen striding along, hiking her dress up over her thighs to make it easier for her to run. It shouldn't really come as any surprise to learn that the women's competition at Olympia, at the Festival of Hera, was dominated by Spartan women. At Sparta, the health and the training of women was prized as much as the training of men. After all, these Spartan women were destined to be the wives and the mothers of Spartan warriors. In fact, the only other part of Greece to leave us any information about what we might call women's athletics is a small sanctuary outside of Athens where girls went through a coming-of-age ritual at puberty. And it seems that as part of that rite of passage, while they were at the sanctuary of Artemis, they engaged in running races that were held in honour of the goddess. But if the vase images that we have of these little girls from Brauron are anything to go by, then these girls were no match for the Spartan rivals who dominated at Olympia. And just a little footnote about Hera and her festival, or more specifically about her temple. If you do manage to go to Olympia, and you'll see there the remains of both the temple of Zeus, the major temple in the sanctuary, but you'll also see the temple of Hera, you'll notice an oddity about it, and that is that it is a temple in which every column and column capital is different. They're not standardized. It's the only instance that we have of this in the Greek world, and the probable explanation for it is that the temple originally had wooden columns, and that as the wood decayed and they were replaced successively but at different times with stone columns, the columns were cut separately and individually. So if you see this wonderful squat archaic temple, look at the columns and imagine the Spartan girls who ran in honour of Hera and to win glory like their Spartan brothers. Despite the differences that I've been outlining between the ancient and the modern games, there were ways in which the ancient Olympics were significantly like the modern games. And you may be a little surprised to find what some of these similarities were. They relate to two of the most common laments that are made about the modern Olympics. One often hears, for example, that the modern games are overly commercialized. That's hard to refute. In the blink of an eye, the superstar athletes of today can turn an Olympic gold medal into endorsements worth millions of dollars for everything from running shoes to breakfast cereal. But ancient athletes also profited from their success. Technically, the Olympic victor was only awarded a wreath of wild olive, but in practice it was common, certainly from the 5th century onwards, for an Olympic victor to be treated as a hero at home and to profit from his success. And by profit, I mean financially. In Athens, for example, victors were voted free lunch at the town hall for life, as well as a cash payment worth 500 drachmas. In today's currency, that would come out as somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000. Not a bad reward for a gold medal. Athletes were originally just individuals performing on behalf of themselves and their families' glory, but as the city-states of Greece grew in size during the archaic period, and as they grew in importance, athletes came to represent their community. Now, they didn't actually march behind a national flag, but it was as good as. And so the same creeping professionalism that certainly transformed the modern Olympics from Baron de Coubertin's idea of a purely amateur event to a professional competition, which is what they are today, was precisely the same transformation that the ancient Olympics underwent fairly early in their development, so that for probably 1,000 years of their 1,200-year history, it would be fair to say that the ancient Olympics were professional, not amateur. The second complaint that's often levelled against the modern Olympics is that they can be so easily politicised, with states boycotting for political reasons or using the Games as a showcase for the accomplishments of a nation or an ideology. From the Nazis attempting to turn the 1936 Olympics into a celebration of Aryan superiority, to American athletes giving a Black Power salute, not to mention the Olympics serving as a surrogate for the Cold War, we've seen the Olympics used as a political stage throughout the 20th century. People often assume that the ancient Olympics were somehow more pure. In fact, Avery Brundage of the International Olympic Committee used to say this quite explicitly. But in fact, it's not really true. For a start, Olympia, the home of the ancient Olympics, changed hands on various occasions between towns who competed for control of this neutral territory. And when I say competed for control, I'm talking about armed military invasion. Pisa, not Pisa in Italy, but a Pisa in Western Greece, controlled the sanctuary briefly in the 7th century and again in the 4th century. In fact, in 364 BC, the town of Elis, which was the traditional controller of the Olympic Games, invaded the sanctuary of Olympia to wrest control out of the hands of the Pisatans. And here's an eyewitness account. This is really quite astonishing. He's talking here about the actual Olympiad with competitors competing, and he says the horse race had been completed, as well as the events of the pentathlon. The finalists of the pentathlon who had qualified for the wrestling event were competing not far from the altar, and meanwhile, the attacking troops from Elis came on, pursuing their enemy, who fell back and fought from the roofs of the porticos, while the Eleans defended themselves from ground level. So there's fighting going on with arrows and spears going through the air and soldiers coming to blows, even in the middle of the actual 5 days of the Olympiad in 364. Armed invasions of Olympia were fortunately relatively rare, but politics still played a role. For example, even superpowers like Athens and Sparta could get into trouble if they failed to observe the Olympic truce. In 420 BC, the Spartans were fined a small fortune, 200,000 drachmas, after they attacked an enemy outpost during the Olympic truce. Now, this was not in Olympia. It was nowhere near the territory of Olympia, but the Olympic truce was meant to hold throughout Greece. No one was meant to fight, so that the athletes could make their way, and the spectators, could make their way in peace to Olympia. Well, the Spartans complained that they had not received formal notification of the truce. But the judges turned their appeal down, and when the Spartans refused to pay the fine, they were banned from participating in the next Olympic Games, an Olympic boycott in reverse, if you will. The Olympics were also political in the sense that the sanctuary was decorated with military spoils dedicated by victors in battles. Shields inscribed with the names of Greek cities and other Greek tribes who had been defeated by Greek armies. Imagine this. During the Peloponnesian War, Brasidas, the Spartan general, and his allies at Acanthus up in northern Greece defeated an Athenian army. And they gathered up the shields of the Athenians who they'd driven from the field of battle, and they sent the shields to Olympia, where they were erected in the sanctuary with an inscription on them saying, Brasidas and the Acanthians, victory spoils taken from the Athenians. Imagine what it must have been like if you were an Athenian athlete arriving at Olympia at the next Olympic Games. They could travel there under truce, but they still had their defeat being rubbed into the wounds as they arrived at Olympia. We've been looking at ways in which the ancient and the modern Olympic Games were similar, but the most basic difference between them is that the Olympic Games in antiquity didn't move from place to place like the modern Games. They were always held at Olympia in the Western Peloponnese. It's a pleasant spot, located beneath the hill of Kronos and between two rivers, the Alpheus and the Clarios. All right, that's a nice little description, but you might want to know, why did they choose Olympia? Why not Athens? Why not Sparta or Corinth? It seems particularly odd when you consider that Olympia is isolated. It's a long way from anywhere else. So that, really, it's a bit like putting the modern games permanently in Nebraska. And I mean no insult to anyone from Nebraska. I hope you understand the spirit in which I make that comment. Well, I think there are a number of reasons that the games were held at Olympia, and it's important to think about why the games were located there. The first is that this was a sanctuary of Zeus, and the sanctuary probably predates the games. Zeus is the father of the gods, and the Olympic Games were held in his honor. So we should begin with the sanctuary, and we should always remember that for the Greeks, the Olympic Games were a sacred event. And I don't mean that in any vague metaphorical sense. I mean it in a literal sense. These games were dedicated to the gods. They were performed in honor of the gods, and a victor dedicated some sort of memorial to the gods in thanks for his victory. This was a sacred event, as were all the festivals of the Greeks that included any kind of games. And a second reason, and this may be more important, is that Olympia is so isolated. It doesn't lie in the territory of Sparta. It's far enough away to be outside of the control of wealthy Corinth, and it's certainly beyond the reach of the Athenians. And the significance of this is that Olympia could always remain neutral, offering Greeks from all over Greece the opportunity to compete in a location that was not identified with the political interests of any single Greek state. The Olympic Games were held under a truce, the so-called echecheria, that was declared 1 month in advance, as I've said, to allow athletes and spectators time to travel from all over the Greek world to Olympia. And so Olympia as a location and the Olympiad as a time was a respite from war. The Greeks came from all over the Greek mainland, but they also came from the colonies to the west and from the Black Sea to the north, participating in a festival that honored Zeus and brought athletes personal glory. Now, this neutrality and this isolation is not incidental. It is very important. You see, in antiquity, there was no such thing as a Greek nation. The different regions and the city-states of Greece remained independent, and they only united in times of external invasion. Ironically, the Persians managed to unite Greece, but the Greeks couldn't do it. In the place of political unification, which the Greeks never accomplished, the Greeks found cultural unity. By sharing a common mythology, by sharing a common religion, you could worship Athena in Athens, but you could also worship her in Sparta. By sharing a common language, it had funny accents in different parts of Greece, but nevertheless it was recognizably Greek wherever you went. And by having common cultural practices, the way you dressed, the way you ate, the poetry that you listened to, the songs that you sang, all of these combined to establish a common Greek identity. And seen in that light, the Olympics were one of the most crucial institutions of the Greeks. The Greeks themselves came to recognize that Olympia captured the spirit of what it was to be Greek. Because for the Greeks, all life was a contest. It was a struggle that they would call an agon, a competition. This is the central theme of their drama, in which a protagonist, literally in Greek, the first actor in the agon, or contest, battles verbally with the second character. And you can think of Medea and Jason, or you can think of Antigone and Creon. Greek art is about conflict. Even their plastic arts can be sometimes read as a battle, if you will. Their sculpture being a battle, a contest between the urge to depict reality as it is and the human form as it could be in its ideal state. the Greek states were continually at war with each other, and this spirit of competition, of the Argon, infused all life in ancient Greece. The Olympic Games take that spirit, the spirit of competition, and they make it the essence of the Greek identity. You compete because you are Greek, and you are Greek because you compete. This agonistic impulse, as it's been called, is at the heart of Pan-Hellenism, the idea of Greek identity and Greek cultural unity. During the Peloponnesian War, when the Greek world was convulsed by internecine warfare, Greeks killing themselves everywhere from Sicily to the Aegean in a massive war between the Spartans and their allies and the Athenians and their allies, Aristophanes lamented the fact that Greeks could be brothers at Olympia, yet enemies on the battlefield. And in one of his plays, he has a character say, "In no uncertain terms, I must reproach you, both sides, and rightly. Don't you share a cup at common altars, for common gods, like brothers, at the Olympic Games, at Thermopylae and Delphi? I needn't list the many, many others. The world is full of foreigners you could fight, but it's Greek men and cities you destroy." This peculiar construction of a Greek identity through competition can be understood according to the principle of what anthropologists call peer polity pressure, according to which comparable states end up emulating and competing with each other. And this can be seen most dramatically in the archaeology of the shrine at Olympia, the sanctuary of Zeus at Olympia. And I hope that perhaps if you haven't been there already, after this lecture, you may be inspired to go to Olympia and to look at what's there to be seen on the ground. And before discussing the archaeology, I just want to acknowledge here the work of the German Archaeological Institute that has excavated for over 125 years at Olympia and has done a splendid job of bringing to light the ancient buildings. In addition to the major buildings, such as the Temple of Zeus that I've mentioned and the Temple of Hera that I've already discussed, and in addition to the hero shrine of Pelops, one of the great heroes of the Peloponnese, and of course the altar where all the sacrifices took place, the northern side of the sanctuary of Zeus was marked by a terrace along which sat a series of treasury houses. These resembled small temples, and they were erected to house the dedications made by the victorious states and their athletes. They include a treasury of Gela, a treasury of Metapontum, a treasury of Cyrene, another for Sybaris, another for Syracuse, and a treasury of Byzantium. Now, the locations, not of the treasuries, but of the home states that erected them, the locations are very revealing. Gela, Metapontum, Sybaris, Syracuse are all in the Greek west. They're in Sicily and in southern Italy. Byzantium, on the other hand, is located at the entrance to the Black Sea in the Greek northeast, while Cyrene is located in Libya. These are all overseas cities, not from the Greek mainland, but rather Greek colonies. For these Greek colonies, having athletes competing at Olympia was a dramatic assertion that no matter where they lived, they were still Greek. And the non-architectural dedications at Olympia tell the same story. And again, if you went to Olympia in antiquity, this is what you saw. You didn't just see the Olympic Games. You saw the hundreds and thousands of dedications that had been erected as memorials by the athletes to say thank you to the gods for their victory. Chariots dedicated by Hero and Galon from Sicily. A chest representing Ajax of Locri in southern Italy. A semicircular pedestal dedicated by the people of Apollonia from the Black Sea region. A statue of Zeus dedicated by the people of Metapontum in Italy. And another statue of Zeus dedicated by three private individuals, Hippagoras, Phrynon, and Inesidemus, all, again, from the Greek west. So it was Greeks from the mainland, Greeks from the colonies, Greeks from everywhere coming to compete in the spirit of Homeric competition and celebrating their Greek cultural identity in a neutral venue. And we shouldn't forget the other activities that went on connected to the games. It may seem as if the idea of a cultural Olympiad, which is now something that we do every 4 years, is a modern invention. But in fact, the ancient Olympics also included non-athletic events. So, for example, at Olympia, during the course of the Olympics, there would not only be sacrifices to Greek gods and prayers and rituals that were being copied by every other Greek city, but there were poets and musicians there as well. And there were historians too, all present, composing the works that they had been commissioned to create, hymns in honour of the Olympic victors, or reading their most recent historical work, or performing for an audience. And these audiences would be both Thessalian and Spartan and Corinthian and Syracusan. But in addition to that, they were Greek. It was that competition that allowed the Greeks to surmount their differences and to become fully Greek. And that's why the Greeks referred to the Olympic Games as being pan-Hellenic. They were for all the Greeks. And there was no greater glory than to be a victor at each of the pan-Hellenic Games, the games held at Olympia, at Delphi, at Nemea, and at Isthmia. A champion who won at all of these was called a periodonikes, a circuit victor. Victors were celebrated in the kinds of anecdotes that I told earlier about Milo of Croton, but the Olympic victors also received a very particular kind of praise that takes us right back to where we began, the Homeric hero. Because the Olympic victors were praised by poets like Pindar, who in the 5th century composed Olympic odes, and he tells us in some of these odes how he understood the task of the poet. "Ample," says Pindar, "is the glory stored for Olympian winners. Thereof my shepherd tongue is fain to keep some part in fold, but only by the help of Zeus is wisdom kept ever blooming in the soul. Son of Archestratus, Agasidamus, I know certainly that for your boxing I will lay a glory of sweet strains upon your crown of golden olive, and will have in remembrance the race of the Locrians in the west." What happens in the hands of Pindar is that Olympic heroes are being turned into Homeric heroes. And when we turn our Olympic victors into movie stars, we are doing the very same thing that the Greeks did to theirs. So the Games remained a bedrock institution of Greek life. If anything, they even gained in prestige when Greece lost its independence and became a province of the Roman Empire. So that in the 2nd century AD, as the Olympics passed their 900th birthday, Strabo could write, "The glory of the temple persists on account both of the festal assembly and of the Olympic Games, in which the prize was a crown and which were regarded as sacred, the greatest games in the world. The temple was adorned by its numerous offerings, which were dedications there from all parts of Greece." Well, that was when they were 900 years old, and they went on to last for nearly another 300 years. Let's hope that our Olympic Games have the same longevity. Because, well, they're as enjoyable today as they were in antiquity.
We hope you've enjoyed these free lectures on the ancient Olympics. See the list of Professor McInerney's courses on our website, or explore more courses in history, science, math, fine arts, and more, available on DVD, audio CD, and audio download. It is our pleasure at The Teaching Company to provide you with the joy of lifelong learning every day with great professors, great courses, and a lifetime guarantee of your satisfaction. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call us at 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you from all of us at The Teaching Company.
And there you have it, the second lecture about the Olympic Games. Just a side comment about the Teaching Company. I got an email recently about a sale, and I always love a sale. So I looked through it, and they had a a lecture series that seemed very interesting to me. It's a 12 lecture series about the Federalists and discussions about the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists and the formation of the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. Well, for a political science major like myself, this is great fodder. And the download of all 12 lectures was available for $19.95. Now, teaching company courses can be, that's about as inexpensive as I ever see them. They can be hundreds of dollars. Some are $500, $600, $650. If you watch for the sales, you can get, say, a $600 series for maybe $149, $229, something like that, on CD or on DVD. And there are different prices. The DVDs are always the most expensive, CDs, cassettes, and then the download, and the download includes PDF files and so forth. Well, I thought, I never did a download, so I'll try it. The accessibility could have been better. I had to kind of find my way around the site, and ordering was easy, but the downloading was somewhat difficult. I had to get some tech support on the phone to understand the interface well enough. Having done it once, I know I could do it again without any great difficulty. But the first time is a little bit trying to one's patience. But as I say, I think if you do it once, it'll work well. I got the material down, and it works very well online for those of you who might want to learn in that way. So just wanted to share that comment. Question. Maybe there's somebody out there who remembers this. I got an email today for a company called Amazability, and the emails come from a guy named Kenneth Ingham. I'm sitting here racking my brain trying to remember who Kenneth Ingham is. I should know. Seems to me he had something to do with early Braille translation, but the name is not one that I know real well. Amazability is a package for visually impaired people containing word processing, apparently a programmer's workbench, email, address books, things like that. I'll look into it further, and perhaps we can have Ken or a representative from that company on a future program if you guys think you'd be interested in doing that. Okay, we are moving along, getting down to the last maybe 12 minutes of Blind Vine for today. The phone numbers to call, 888-881-1998. For those outside the U.S., 415-217-6667. 888-881-1998, 415-217-6667. Amazing, you announce a number and sometimes the phone rings. Good afternoon, you're on Blind Vine. Thank you for calling, and introduce yourself and tell me where you're from.
I'm Jim Eccles, and I'm from Washington.
I see, and we've got two calls. Just a moment, Jim. Hello, you're on Blind Vine. Can I ask?
I am from San Francisco.
Okay, you're caller number two. I will be back.
Okay.
Jim, good afternoon.
Since
you're in Vancouver, I know it is afternoon for you.
Yes, actually it is.
How's everything going?
Oh, fine. I thought the lecture was great. I think the thing that kind of makes me sad when I think about the Olympics is that, as I understand it, I've never gotten a TV guide from somewhere else and looked, but I'm told that in other countries, when they hold the Paralympics, which usually come a couple of weeks after the regular Olympics, then that's watched by a lot of people in different countries. But here in the U.S., we sort of marginalize it. Maybe it's a special, it's 2 hours on a Sunday evening some months later, or you could go on and watch it in the Internet, but the spirit of the Olympics, at least from the spectator's point of view, hasn't penetrated the Paralympics, at least here in the States. And I did love the lecture too. I've heard some of those same myths. You know, I was going along, he ran and he was dead. Oh, it's a myth. Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, and now Thermopylae. Man.
Yeah, well, that's life. But the myth's a good story, like he said.
Yeah, it makes a good story. People hear it, I heard it as a pretty young kid. I think I remember taking Greek history in the seventh grade, and then that's what you those myths and stories stick with you.
Yes, yes, they sure do. Those and all the gods and goddess tales that we read as kids.
I always wished I could jump as high and do as much stuff as they could in a single day, or just make the damn day longer, you know?
I wish they would do a one-hour or a half-hour lecture about the renovation of Olympia, just the archaeological renovation. That would be fascinating to hear.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the lecture. I'm glad you caught the program today. Please come again, call again. We'll try and have some other exciting stuff.
Great. Good hearing the program, and glad you, I guess, you finished up so we weren't stuck in the middle.
That's right. That's right. All right. Talk to you later. Okay. Caller number two. Did that sound like Marvelina?
It is.
Okay.
How did you know? Good guess.
Well, that's probably a guess I shouldn't miss.
I hope not.
Anyway, how did you like the lecture?
I love the lecture. I found it very informative, very informational.
Yeah, he's a good speaker. I would guess he's probably from Australia or New Zealand, but I don't know. I haven't read his bio from the Teaching Company website.
Yeah, it didn't really say where he was from originally, did it?
Yeah, I'm sure it does on the website somewhere if you dig it up.
I wonder if you could tell me more about the Teaching Company and other lecture services they provide, is it, or to the listeners.
I can't tell you about other lectures per se.
Do you know what other topics they might lecture on?
They have a whole series of courses, and everything from the creating of high school level competency in mathematics, algebra, geometry, to college level courses. And the college courses are political in nature. They have a whole series of politics courses, a whole series of humanities courses, art, music, the humanities. There's a whole series of literature courses, a number of ancient history courses, and fewer but seemingly a growing number of modern history courses.
Okay.
I'd say they probably have about 60 courses altogether.
So they have a bevy of different subjects that they lecture on.
Oh, yeah. Lots of different stuff. Go to teach12.com? Or is it teaching12.com? I can never remember. Anyway, if nothing else, Google Teaching Company and you'll find them that way.
All right. Thank you. I'll do that.
Okay.
Have a good day.
All right. Thanks for the call.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye. And as I say, the courses themselves are in all different price ranges, and the prices vary significantly from one time of the year to another. They say that at least once each year, all their courses go on sale. So I wait for the sales. In fact, the way I ever found out about them was just through a mailer that promoted their courses and offered about 20 or 30 of them on sale. And I thought, well, you know, these are deep discounts. I'll try a few and see what happens. The music courses are especially nice because they have snapshots of symphonies or different kinds of music you can listen to, and that makes it even more fun. Telephone numbers are 888-881-1998 or 415-217-6667. And we have only a very few minutes left. I will play one of my favorite New Orleans jazz bands who you never heard of before, but can enjoy, and wait for your call. If someone calls in, we'll go straight to the call. 888-881-1998, 415-217-6667. 6667. From? Did I even catch the call? Hello, hello. You are on Blind Vine, and if you would care to introduce yourself, we'd love to hear from you. Hello. Hello, hello. Well,
sleepy time down south, soft winds blowing through the pine wood trees. Folks down there lead a life of ease. When I see my mama fall down on her knees, sleepy time down south. Steamboats on the river, they're coming, they're going, they're splashing the night away. Folks are singing, I hear banjos ringing, and they dance till the break of day.
This is Blind.
Dear old Southland with its dreams.
Oh, hey, Robin,
song.
Hang on a second. Let me put you on the air. Hold on 1 second.
Where I'm long, all curled round in my baby's arms.
We have one last call for the show. Robin, are you hearing us?
I am hearing you.
Excellent, excellent.
Yeah, this is Robin from Oakland and a friend of Chris's. And I've been taking the tapes from the teaching company for some time, and being a philosophy major back in the old days, I've got Jewish intellectual history, 16th to 20th century, and I've also got an existentialist tape, No Excuses, Existentialism and the Meaning of Life. Once you get into it, and again, I'm cited, so once I get into it, then I get catalogs periodically, very often,
right,
in fact,
right,
more than I need them.
And, but yeah, exactly.
The sales are very good. You could very often get stuff for $68. You can get stuff for $100. And these are courses that have like about 20 different lectures or so.
Right, right.
So it's a really good deal.
Great. Well, thank you for that.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And this brings us to the end of another edition of Blind Vine. Thank you all for calling. Appreciate your participation. Thank those of you who listened who did not call this week. There's always next week. You're listening to Blind Vine. I'm your host, Chris Gray, from beautiful downtown San Francisco. And you're listening to ACB Radio Mainstream, the voice of the blind community. Thank you, and we'll talk to you next week.